Hello and welcome to episode 11 of The Lawdown. I am Sarah Chilton, a partner at CM Murray.
And I'm Beth Hale, also a partner at CM Murray.
And we're really sorry that this episode is not on our two-week regular schedule.
I mean, insofar as you can ever call it a regular schedule, but yeah.
Things
this one's
quite,
particularly
quite late. Busy.
They have.
With us. And obviously we're now into summer holiday season, so that makes the people left busy too. So the Lawdown has unfortunately fallen a little bit behind, but we're here, we're back, and we're going to bring you some hopefully interesting stories. So you could say that we'd just been waiting for some really interesting stories to
come up. Exactly, waiting for the thrilling stuff.
Yeah.
So today we are going to talk about a few topics. The first one is, they're not called super injunctions in the Employment Tribunal, but anonymous businessmen and their alleged misconduct. The second one is another story about a rich businessman, someone who, Andrea Orsell, who was going to be CEO of Santander but had his job offer withdrawn at the last minute and is now allegedly, apparently, suing them.
For a lot of money.
And we're going to talk about that and the law behind that story. And then we are going to do a little bit of a geek section in relation to post-termination restrictive covenants and a recent Supreme Court judgment that was handed down a couple of weeks ago. And finally, we're going to talk about tweets.
Yeah. So, what are we starting with?
So let's start with restricted reporting orders, which is essentially a way in which you can ensure that your identity is not disclosed when you are involved in employment tribunal proceedings.
So this came up because there was a big story that hit the press via The Times a couple of weekends ago, or maybe even longer than that. And essentially, The Times were quite, I would say, annoyed that they were had been unable to report the identity of a multimillionaire businessman who was allegedly
Mr. X,
who was allegedly accused of some quite serious, I think, allegations of harassment and bullying in the workplace. And they had been party, actually, to the Employment Tribunal proceedings because they had entered into the proceedings with a view to trying to get his identity to be revealed. And the background to it was that proceedings were brought against him as an individual and also the company that he was a senior person within. And the proceedings obviously were detailing the allegations against him, and he, as a result, wanted to be anonymised in the course of those proceedings. And he asked the tribunal for his identity to remain confidential and anonymous. And what the tribunal do in that context is they have the power to grant such an order, and essentially then that's where you get the judgments that say X against Y or A against B. And so he became just a letter. And in fact, so did the claimant in that case as well. They also had their identity anonymised.
Can I just, sorry, just to interrupt you briefly, ask you a question. How, what circumstances, what the circumstances have to be sort of satisfied for a tribunal to grant that kind of order?
So employment tribunals can make a restricted reporting order in a variety of circumstances. Most commonly, those circumstances will often relate to issues relating to sexual offences or sexual harassment. Under the old rules, which were in effect until a few years ago, the most common order is related to national security, sexual misconduct or disability. That has now been widened, so someone subject to an employment tribunal, either as a respondent, as a claimant or as a witness, can apply to have some sort of restricted reporting order made by the tribunal in respect of other issues, anything that they may, for example, not want disclosed in the wider public domain, such as things about their personal life, their family life. Equally, some people might try and seek a restricted reporting order in respect of things like sensitive company data, and that's inevitably going to be more difficult than someone who, for example, seeks a restricted reporting order in relation to, for example, being the victim of a sexual assault or sexual harassment allegation. And the two main types of orders that one person might look to get in an employment tribunal would be an anonymity order, which would, for example, mean that that person's identity would be secret. So that's where you get judgments that are referred to X and Y, A and B, etc. And the other type of order would be an order that restricts the reporting of perhaps a particular part of the evidence or a particular topic. So, for example, in a disability discrimination case, there might be an order made to restrict the reporting of the medical records and medical information in relation to a claimant who's disabled, because that information is sensitive and personal to that person and could impact upon their life if it was broadly publicised. And when a tribunal comes to consider an application for one of these orders, it needs to give full weight to the principle of open justice. So that's the principle in the UK, that justice needs to be open to the public and people need to be able to see that justice is done and scrutinise that process. But also the convention, the European Convention of Human Rights, convention right to freedom of expression. And a key factor of a restricted reporting order is that it should not extend beyond the decision or the judgment in the case on liability. So what you often get is restricted reporting during the trial so that witnesses can't be influenced or feel that they can't speak freely. But then actually when judgment is delivered, that restricted reporting order will inevitably lift. And one thing just to say about that is that in respect of an anonymity order, that's slightly different because they can be permanent. And the only other thing that needs to be noted about these types of orders is that people who've been victims of sexual offences are automatically protected under the criminal law from having their identity revealed in a tribunal process. So their identity may always be completely confidential. And one of the issues that came into this particular case in the judgment was that the judge was concerned that if they revealed the identity of the alleged perpetrator, then the identity of the victims might be, by a jigsaw effect, is what they said, revealed as well. So there was a concern around that. One of the key things that seemed to come out in this judgment from the Employment Appeal Tribunal was that the relevance of the person's honour and reputation was a factor to be taken into account, but that the relevance of a person's social status and standing was not a factor to be taken into account. And the reason that that latter factor should not be taken into account in the view of the Employment Appeal Tribunal judge is because effectively that would infringe upon the principle of equality of justice that we have in the UK. So it's a difficult balancing act for tribunals, but they are orders which can be quite common, albeit most people don't actually know that they're available. And it just so happened that from what appears to be the story, between the matter being referred back to the Employment Tribunal for a decision and it coming up for a hearing, the matter appears to have been resolved, we presume by confidential settlement. And then it was reported that the claimant had entered into a non-disclosure agreement, which ensued then a big debate again about the use of non-disclosure agreements. Nevertheless, quite interesting to see
There was a lot of discussion around NDAs in relation to this case, when in fact
the NDA here was not
really at play. But yes.
But I think the interesting point about NDAs that came out of it was that, in fact, there was a lot of criticism on, you know, what I read in the press and on Twitter about the use of an NDA in this case. But I think what I was mindful of is that what had probably happened is that, yes, the respondent probably was quite sensitive about PR, inevitably, because they went to the hassle and cost of applying for a restricted reporting order. So therefore, one factor in settlement, if that is in fact what happened, was probably the ability for the respondent to keep everything confidential. And so likely, as is what often happens in cases, the claimant was probably offered quite a lot of money and probably offered more money than the tribunal might have been able to award them in circumstances where they had been successful, because tribunal awards are often quite low. And I think it brought back that issue about NDAs are not, you know, just in isolation to be looked at as a problem. You need to kind of look at the whole system. And if tribunal awards are repeatedly quite low, and particularly for harassment claims, they might be particularly low. And in fact, you can get a lot more by giving away your right to speak about it. Then there's an incentive sometimes for some people to give away that right. And if you want to stop the silencing, you might need to also make sure people can claim for more money in the employment tribunal so that there's an actual disincentive for people to...
For people to sign up to them.
Carry. Yeah, exactly.
If you want more information on NDAs...
We have an NDA podcast.
We have an NDA podcast on our separate... So not the Lawdown, but on our separate CM Murray podcast channel.
Yeah, we get into that in a lot more detail.
Yeah. Discuss those issues.
It brings about an interesting question about the availability of restricted reporting orders and other types of privacy orders in justice and in the tribunal and the courts. And I think one of the things that we've spoken about in relation to harassment claims in the employment tribunal is the fact that a lot of the time people are put off bringing them because they're worried about adverse publicity, or they're worried about having to talk about quite private personal things and distressing things in an open forum.
Mm.
And it's not widely known by people bringing employment tribunal claims that in fact they can apply for these types of orders.
Yeah, particularly if they're not advised, particularly if they're taking the litigation themselves and running it themselves. And the tribunal doesn't have any obligation to inform people of that right. So I think it's really important that people understand that they can apply for it, and it's not something the tribunal will just off their own back go, actually, do you know you could apply for this?
And a witness can apply for one as well.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be one of the parties. So if someone's asked to give evidence and they think that giving the evidence might impact upon their family life or, have other adverse impact on some sort of sensitive information about themselves, they could apply as well.
Yeah, and I think it's likely to become more and more common for people to do that who are involved in employment tribunal proceedings since the introduction of the online database of tribunal decisions. So 3 or 4 years ago, it was just sort of announced in a quite low-key way that all employment tribunal decisions, all judgments, were going to be published online. And that includes full judgments which can refer to the names of witnesses, can refer to everyone involved in the case. It also includes decisions which are simple dismissal of a claim decision. So often if you settle a claim on confidential terms, the tribunal will then have to, in order to, if the claim's already been issued, the tribunal will have to give a dismissal decision, essentially, and those are also published with names unless you get a restricted reporting order or reply for that. So in circumstances where the parties may have decided to conclude the matter on confidential terms, then in order to avoid an open hearing sometimes, the judgment might still go onto that database.
Yeah.
And I think people don't know that. It's not obvious to people, and it was very kind of underreported at the time. There was, not much sort of fanfare was made of the fact that all these decisions are now going to be available online. And it's also slightly arbitrary because they're not always put up. So sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. It's a bit random as to whether the sort of administrators have got around to doing it. So it's a bit unpredictable.
Yeah. And so moving on to bankers.
Yes.
So Beth, we recently saw press reporting that Andrea Orcel, who was formerly of UBS and had been offered the job as CEO of Santander, had his job offer withdrawn and is, we understand, in Spain, suing Santander for allegedly 100 million euros.
Something like that, yeah.
Alleging that that's the loss that he suffered. Or I think the claim is reported to be either for 100 million euros or to have his job.
Or
to be appointed CEO and to be allowed to start. But what's the legal position? Because can't they just take him on and fire him on week one? Why does he think he can get 100 million euros?
So I think for him, the big issue is that they offered him essentially a sign-on bonus, which was intended to compensate him for the loss that he would suffer as a result of leaving UBS. So he had various payments which were due to him from UBS, which if he joined Santander, he would lose because he was going to a competitor, I think. And so Santander were going to make him good on those amounts that he would lose from UBS. And he had already lost those amounts. I think he had already lost those amounts. And so therefore, what he is trying to claim is that that Santander, in withdrawing his job offer, he had already resigned from UBS. So he hasn't left yet, I think. I think he's working out his notice or maybe on garden leave. But the damage was already done with UBS, so he was already standing to lose that money, and then Santander were going to what he says is they still owe him that amount because of the money that he's lost. And what I think they say is, we never had a binding contract, we'd made you an offer, you resigned, and that offer was always subject to and conditional upon various things, and now we decided to withdraw it. And tough. And you're right that he could have gone there and they could have dismissed him very quickly, and depending on the terms of that contract, he may not have had all those payments due to him. So I think it's hard to see, certainly under UK law, exactly how that claim would be framed. But I think it's the losses, I think, that he suffered as a result of leaving UBS and that they were going to make him good on.
Mm. And it is obviously quite common in banking that if you leave one bank and go to a competitor, you will often leave losing all your deferred compensation. typically in banks, people get paid, well, people who earn a lot of money get paid deferred compensation over usually a period of 3 or 5 years.
Mm.
And often if you leave, particularly, it's slightly different usually if you get made redundant, but if you leave to join a competitor, usually the deal is, well, you walk away from that money that you've not yet been paid out. So you might have 2 or 3 years worth of stocks and shares and bonuses that you've not received, and you typically lose it. But typically your new employer will say, right, well, we'll make you whole for that money.
Yeah, depending on how he's lost. Sort of bargaining position. Mm. Yeah, but he's lost, obviously, on an extremely grand scale.
Yeah.
But it was just, we were talking, weren't we, about what kind of claim that might give rise to in a sort of more normal situation where someone has had a job offer.
Which they've resigned.
They've resigned from their job. And then, for example, the new employer takes references and their references aren't up to scratch, so they withdraw the job offer. And whether people in those circumstances have a potential claim.
Yeah. It's funny, we get asked quite a lot by people who are leaving. We might be advising them on the terms of their new role, or we might be advising them on their obligations to their current employer in the context of their resignation, or what obligations they might owe during their notice period. And they often then say, so should I resign now before I've got my offer from my new job? And I always say no, because you might end up with no job. But it's amazing, I think, how in reality a huge number of people resign without having signed up fully to a new offer. I think the other thing that people often do is they get an offer that's conditional, and you mentioned that there might be conditions on this offer, and they resign on the back of a conditional offer without those conditions having been satisfied, like
that's
references.
But that's often because, for example, I mean, in a sort of, you know, really normal day-to-day situation, someone won't want their reference, that the referee there, they will say, get a reference from my current employer, but they won't want that reference to be taken up until they've resigned. So they will often resign, then the new employer will take up the reference with the current employer, and if the current employer says something in that reference which makes the new employer change their mind, then it's you know, puts everyone in a bit of a difficult position.
And
there would be no breach of contract in those circumstances, unless the employee could say, well, that reference was satisfactory, or that, you know, they show in some way that they've behaved unreasonably. But even then, your losses, the employee, it would have to be a sort of breach of contract claim, unless it was a discrimination claim, which I'll come on to in a minute. But if it's a breach of contract claim, then, as you say, the person could start work and then be dismissed very quickly. And often you have a shorter notice period in that early part of your employment. You might have a probation period where your notice period is a week or 2 weeks. And so your losses are only those contractual losses. It's slightly different where if the job offer is withdrawn because of some discriminatory reason. So because, so for example, if the old employer says, oh, you don't want to employ that person, they're a right pain, they brought a discrimination claim against us.
Or they do a medical questionnaire or assessment, the new employer does one, and then they discover that someone has a disability and they think, oh, we don't want that. It'd be interesting to see how that moves through. As I say, it was reported as in the Spanish court, so obviously the law in Spain might be entirely different.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Caveat, we are not advising Spanish law.
It's not just it'd be nice to practice from Barcelona, but, you know.
One day.
We're not. So moving on to our next case, this is our geeky segment in our podcast. But it's, I think, justifiable in these particular circumstances, because a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court hands down the first judgment on restricted covenants for over 100 years.
Yeah, on employment restricted covenants for over 100 years.
True, there are other types of restricted covenants that we just don't deal with.
And we have actually mentioned this case before when it was heard in the Supreme Court, which was in January. So it's taken a very long time for the Supreme Court to actually...
There's a lot to think about.
Hand its judgment down, complicated issues.
We went to the Supreme Court. So
we did, in true geek style, we went to the Supreme Court to hear the judgment being handed down, which was quite exciting.
So you might remember from an episode before that this case was about someone called Mrs. Tillman, who worked for headhunters Egon Zehnder. And she left Egon Zehnder. And there was a clause in her employment contract which effectively sought to prevent her from being, the words were, concerned or interested in a competitor. And her position was that what that actually did was prevented her from being concerned or interested in, and prevented her from, one, being employed by or owning a business that competed, but also that it would have prevented her from having an even minority shareholding in a competitive business. And her position was that if that was what that clause meant, that was far too wide to be enforceable by Egon Zehnder. And that comes from the principle that when seeking to draft and then enforce restrictive covenants in employment and partnership, employers and firms seeking to do that need to be careful that what they draft doesn't go further than is reasonably necessary to protect their legitimate business interests. And arguably, having a 1% shareholding in a competitor of Egon Zehnder, if she had gone and done that, that would not have had an adverse impact on their business interests.
Yes,
so therefore, it went wider than it was necessary.
Yeah.
So there were two key points that the Supreme Court was asked to decide. The first one was, is that in fact what interested meant in these circumstances? Was it that wide, and did it in fact seek to prevent her from holding that minority shareholding? And the second point was, if it was that wide and it did seek to prevent her from doing that, could it be severed? And that basically means, could they remove that word, delete that word from the clause and enforce the clause in its reduced form? And so on the first point, whether interested in had that meaning, the Supreme Court said yes, it did. And the fact that that is not what she wanted to do. She admitted that what she wanted to do was go and work for a competitor. She didn't want to hold a minority shareholding, but the very fact that it purported to prevent her from doing that meant that it was too wide and therefore was not enforceable in its current form. But on the second point, what the Supreme Court held, which overturned the decision of the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court held that those words could be deleted from the clause and then the clause could be enforced against Mrs. Tillman with those words gone.
Which I think will be a relief to most employers and firms, you know, who might have partners, because actually I think a lot of people probably have those words concerned or interested in.
Yeah,
in
that, I think that's why this case has been so interesting to so many people, is because that wording has been very used as standard over a number of years in senior exec contracts for all sorts of employers. So it's quite
And I think people also had got used to the concept that you could strike one word out provided it didn't majorly change the meaning of the covenant.
Yeah.
And the idea that from the Court of Appeal that you couldn't do anything to that covenant, even if it wouldn't massively change the meaning.
So what
of
the
it,
Court of
was
Appeal
scary
said is
that
you can only ever sever, you can only ever delete bits if they are separate covenants.
Yeah.
And so that led to a lot of people sort of drafting covenants which were in which every single promise was made in a different clause, and you know, you had a semicolon and a pressed enter between every single word. So
and it was a point validly made by one of the barristers who appeared in that case, who won for Egon Zehnder, Adam Solomon at Littleton. And he made the point that the law shouldn't turn, or your success in a case shouldn't turn, on whether or not you pressed enter and a comma in a clause, which I think is really sensible. And I think we have all been being super cautious and putting a lot of semicolons and returns into our clauses.
Yeah.
But if you think about it in the way he expressed it, it's a completely pointless position to find yourself in.
Yes.
If that is the critical difference between something working and something not working.
So I think what you certainly shouldn't take away from this is that you can draft whatever you like and the court will fix it for you. That's very clearly not the case. You still need to make sure they're really tightly drafted and that you're not putting in wording which is unnecessary.
It's also very minor amendments that will be allowed because they can't majorly change the meaning. So, you know, striking out a whole sentence will clearly change the meaning. Taking out one word in that context may not change the meaning, but in some contexts it might if drafted differently.
And also the court gave a sort of little cautionary sting in the tail at the end of the judgment, which is that they said that where an employer had not drafted the restrictive covenant properly, and therefore they called it legal litter, I think, in the legal landscape, that there were words which were used unnecessarily or included unnecessarily, they said that the likelihood would be that the employer in those circumstances would have to pay the costs of any court case. So that's, you know, they might win in terms of being able to enforce the restriction, but they might have to pay dearly.
It all comes back to, you should just make sure you get it as right as you can in the first place.
Get it right first time.
And update them regularly, because the problem is thinking changes on this. Okay, the law probably doesn't change in 100 years, but thinking on it changes. And also, more than that, your business changes and what you need to protect might change, and
people's
the market
change.
Might change.
People move up through the organisation.
So constant reviewing, updating is required, because otherwise you could find yourself losing someone who takes all this amazing skill and contacts and database, you know, well, they don't take the database physically, but, you know, in their head.
In their head.
And losing them and being massively disruptive to your business because you didn't update your covenants every year or two.
Yeah.
So that geek bit over, we're on to tweet of the week or tweet of the month because we've probably not done this for long enough. And it's not really a tweet of the week because a tweet of the week would imply we liked the tweet.
No. It's more the tweet that the tweets that have
caused the most
discussion and and controversy this week, which were Donald Trump's racist tweets about the other Congress, about the four Congresswomen, and the extraordinary storm to which that has given rise, and people's reluctance to use the word racist, which I found absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, I know, and I suppose it got us thinking, just to bring this back to employment law. If someone had done that in the context of being an employee, they'd probably get sacked.
Yeah. And I think, so there's quite a lot of case law around when you can, and we've talked about it also on the Law Down before, about when you can sack. In fact, I think in our last episode, we talked about sports stars and homophobic tweets.
Yes,
particularly.
We did.
But, so, I mean, there are circumstances in which you can be dismissed for social media use and for inappropriate postings on social media. There was actually a recent case in the last few weeks where someone had posted something really inappropriate on Facebook and it was held not to be in the course of employment, and the employer was not, that dismissal was unfair because it was on a personal Facebook page. No one from her work was friends with her on Facebook. It was, it just happened to be seen by someone else. It was done outside of work hours on a personal computer. There was no kind of relation between the Facebook post and the employee, sorry, and the employer. So that in those circumstances, it was held that wasn't in the course of employment. But
tweeting is POTUS.
Yes, I mean
think
pretty,
Donald Trump, that actual situation. He's definitely doing it in the course of being president of the US. So you know,
yeah. I mean, he can't be dismissed. But, you know.
Oh, how different the world would be if
indeed.
He could be.
Indeed.
But yeah, it's interesting. The reactions have been interesting.
Reactions have been really interesting.
So on that happy note about state of world politics, we have come to the end of this episode of The Lawdown. Yeah. We will be back, hopefully sooner than our hiatus has been this time round. And maybe the summer will give us a little bit more time. I'm not sure, to come back in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, and maybe we'll have some guests.
And maybe we will.
Contributors.
Yeah. We're looking forward to that. We're currently speaking to a few people who are quite keen to come on and talk. So,
if you have any ideas for who you'd like to hear on the Law Down,
or if you want
to
come on as a guest,
or indeed if you want to come on as a guest, let us know.
We're at info@cm-murray.com. We'll also put the details of how to get in touch with us in the podcast notes. And thank you for listening. If you've liked this episode, please rate it and review it and share it, because that's how other people find out about our episodes too, and how more people can listen to us. And if you have any questions, let us know.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.